Southern Michigan cherries. All right, I just want to first of all remind everybody about the upcoming first paper that is due, I forget, I think it's the 6th or something? It's
the 8th.
The 8th? Yeah. Okay, so it's due in a couple of weeks. I guess that's probably 2 weeks from today. Yeah. You're free to hand it in early. You know, that's that just gives me extra time. As I explain in the syllabus, for the first two papers, after I give you back comments, you can revise the paper. And I just, you know, and I'll reread it, give you more comments. The grade on the paper will be, if you revise it, the first one gets dropped completely. It's just whatever the final revision would be. I absolutely, as I'm sure you just assume, categorically do not grade on any kind of curve. I would be thrilled if every paper was wonderful. I care, in terms of what I care about on the papers, it's clarity and the care with which you work on the ideas, more than it is sort of stunning originality and, you know, brilliant insight. I mean, of course, it's a pleasure as a intellectual to read stunning originality and brilliant insight. Occasionally it happens in these short papers, you know. And it's always, you know, one of the things that I've found interesting over the years is that sometimes among the class, there's students who, you know, clearly really know the material, they're very quick with it and all that. And then there's students who are struggling with it, and then they write these fantastic papers that, in which they just had a quirky way of looking at something that really, they didn't realize how original it was, the way they were doing it. They thought they were just trying to figure something out. But in a way, because they were more struggling with the materials, they were also making themselves open to just figuring out something in a more novel way. So I have, over the years, had these fantastically surprising papers. And those of you who become professors eventually, I'm sure there'll be at least some of you are hoping to. It's one of the great pleasures to be shown that your expectations about what you kind of, you know, you develop a sort of sense of what sort of paper you might get from somebody, it turns out to be completely wrong. And that's heartening to be completely wrong about that. I don't want my expectations to be continually affirmed. Okay, I care about clarity. If I have to struggle to figure out what you mean, that it's not that I get resentful. I mean, I might sometimes, but that's not the issue. It's just that's the main hurdle, clarity. Read your paper out loud to yourself. Usually, if there's awkwardness, lack of transitions, non sequiturs, you'll hear it, because you'll read it. If you read somebody else's paper, you'll see it, even if you don't see it. Read your paper out loud to yourself. Clarity and the seriousness with which you kind of bring your powers to bear on it. And as I explained also, there's no strict length issue. Papers need to be as long as they need to be. But papers are more, it's usually more of a problem that they're longer than needed than shorter than needed. Sometimes they're too stripped down. They just needed more exposition and discussion. But mostly, when there's an issue of length in a paper, it's because they're longer than needed. And I suppose I'm more sensitive to that just because I have to read them all and write careful comments on them. So longer will tend to be more of an issue. You should try not to have the pure expositional part where you're simply summarizing what's in the reading be more than about a quarter of the length. You know, a couple of pages is fine. Sometimes it's necessary to be longer in certain specific contexts. And also, the reason why these kind of mechanical instructions never really work, exactly what constitutes a mere summary of an article versus an analysis of it. That is, in the summary, you are parsing the points and reorganizing it. You know, sometimes what might look with a soft focus as a summary is actually an analysis. That's why I don't want to give kind of strict formulas for this. It really depends upon how it goes. You should feel free to send me an email ahead of time if you have thoughts about the paper you want to write, to check it out with me. I mean, not checking it out in the sense of getting permission to do it, but any thoughts I might have about how you might sharpen the topic or focus it. The papers have to be anchored in one of the core readings, or more than one, it can be. But I think in general it's turned out to be better when people pick a single reading and really hone in on it. Sometimes students are worried they won't have enough to say, so they take five articles and or five readings from two different sections and try to... Generally, I think it's better to get real depth and care in grappling with one or two points rather than taking on too much. Yeah.
Is it okay if we take one particular concept that might appear in multiple readings, but maybe take that concept from one or two readings, but is it like a particular point instead of, because a lot of the readings have a lot of...
Yeah, sure, absolutely. And you don't have, when you take a reading, I don't mean that you have to engage the entire reading. Absolutely, you don't. I don't want a book review type essay, right? It's also completely appropriate to take some idea that is in the reading, explain what it means, and then apply it to a different context. So I know some of you are doing master's theses, dissertations, other research projects. Among the undergraduates, you've taken other kinds of courses in which you see resonances between things that we're reading and some history course that you had, and you might want to ask, how can I use this concept to understand this historical process that I've studied elsewhere? That's completely fine. The papers, I don't put any real constraint on what kind of paper you write. It can be taking a concept, applying it to something else, comparing two concepts, or just really delving into the readings in the form of a assessment and critique or commentary. Really, it's whatever will be most useful for you. For the simplest kind of paper is one where you have read an article or a chapter, you find it really interesting, your own thoughts got stimulated by one of the ideas, and you write a paper just directly commenting on that reading and extending your own ideas into it in whatever way you might, so that it's really contained within the course itself rather than trying to be more expansive. And that, I think, you should think of as the default. And that shouldn't be thought of as a retreat from something more ambitious. It's really probably the best way to think about this task. Okay, any other questions? Maddie, you had your hand up at one point.
Oh, but... yeah, I was just, like, if you are exploring, you know, one reading, but then there are, like, concepts from other readings.
Oh, sure. Yeah. No, of course. I mean, the whole purpose of this is to write a good... What I want are good papers that'll be interesting to read, and I'll have lots of comments, because the paper stimulated the concepts, not because I'm saying in my comments, you know, this really doesn't make any sense given what you said in the previous, because the two things contradict each other. Of course, some of you will get those kind of comments too. And it's my pleasure as a professor to help enhance coherence. But no, I just want interesting things to read. Entertain me, that would be... Well, that's a dangerous thing to say. I once did get a paper that was a long poem, and no graduate student would have been so bold as to do something like that. It was a kind of quirky undergraduate, and I gently suggested that without penalty he should write a second paper, but because it just didn't work as an analysis of the ideas. Okay. All right, that's housekeeping.
I'm vaguely, I might be confusing yours with another syllabus, but do we have to give comments on each other's papers?
Oh, you're not confusing. Thank you for reminding me. So the way it works, for the first two papers, when you bring them to me, you bring me three copies, plus email it to me, because I like to have a digital copy for purposes of writing my comments, but also a hard copy. I will then, what we'll do is we'll trade papers. We'll randomly distribute. You will write then comments on two of your colleagues' papers. And the comments are due a week after you get them. The purposes of having you write comments, that's for the first two papers of the three in the semester. There are multiple purposes served by this exercise. One is that it's often the case that you can diagnose problems in other people's writing that you can't see in your own, but they're the same problems. So I just think it's a good thing to be reading each other's papers. It also develops your own skills as a constructive commentator on other people's work. That's another skill. It's a distinct kind of skill to get inside of somebody else's argument rather than to so it's not so much to criticize the whole endeavor, but to try to improve it from within. It also will make you more appreciative of the amount of time I spend writing comments, for obvious reasons when you have to do it yourself. And those comments will be due the following week. I do want to have copies of the comments you write, not because I will comment on your comments. You know, we're not going to get into an endless loop on this. It's just for accounting purposes. It is a real requirement to write comments, and so I just want to be sure everybody does it.
Do you write them separately, like on a piece of paper?
I think it's, my own view is it's best to write comments out separately rather than just marginal scribbles. You can write marginal scribbles as you read it, but then type up the comments. Be sure to paginate your papers, because that's how typically one pegs a comment on page 7. You said this ridiculous thing, and what does it possibly mean? Hope you don't write comments like that.
If you have to, in addition to papers, we have to comment others, and we can update ours, what would be the due dates for those tasks?
Well, your commenting on other people's papers are due 1 week after they get handed in. And if you want to revise your paper, I try to get your papers back within, it's sort of 10 days, on the Tuesday a week after, not the immediate Tuesday after, but sort of 10 days after you hand them in. I will accept revisions up to a week before the due date for the next paper. Because I don't want revisions from the first paper to spill over into when I'm reading the second paper. I mean, basically what it means is you'll get your comments back on a Tuesday. If you're going to revise your paper, you should do it right away, not let that go for a couple of weeks and then have it bump up against the second paper. Usually a couple of people revise it. I'm not a nasty, I hate grading. I think it interferes with the proper spirit of education, which is reciprocity. I have at times experimented in this course of just simply announcing at the beginning everybody gets an A unless they completely screw around and don't do the work. That works in graduate seminars, particularly because the stakes for graduate students are pretty high in doing a lousy job in a seminar that have nothing to do with grades. It has to do with reputation, which really matters in a graduate course. That's, graduate students don't always realize it, but the only thing that really matters is how well your professors think of you. Grades are irrelevant. No prospective employer is going to look at your transcript, as far as I know. I've been on many search committees in this department. I have never looked at the transcript of a prospective assistant professor. I do look at the letters of recommendation they get. Of course we do. So that's why in graduate seminars you don't have, in a way you can just announce, grades are off the table. In courses with undergraduates, I've tried that and it just has some negative consequences. And that's a cultural problem, not a problem. And it's also because undergraduates are under all sorts of pressures, and if they know that they don't have to work as hard in a particular course because the grade is guaranteed, and they're under lots of pressure from other things, it's understandable. I mean, I'm not just being critical of opportunism, but so I don't just give a blanket assurance that everybody's going to get top grades. But in fact, that's the spirit with which I would like to be operating, and I'm not a tough grader. I'm I give lots of tough feedback, but I don't cash that out in the forms of sharp, demoralizing grading practices. Any other issues around this? Okay. All right, I wanted to make a couple, we got a bit rushed at the end of the last class. The discussion of exploitation and oppression, this is such a rich and interesting cluster of ideas with so many ramifications that it is a shame to pack it all. You know, properly speaking, that it should have been two full sessions, one on the classical labor theory of value, and then one on this alternative approach which emphasizes the social relations that are bound up with interdependencies that we then describe as exploitation. So I just want to spend a few minutes reiterating the central point of the alternative, and then a couple of comments briefly about its extension, which we didn't really get to. So just to reiterate the key idea, human beings enter into all sorts of social relations. One way of thinking about this is that what it means to live in a society, in one type of society versus another, is that certain kinds of social relations are available. They don't have to be invented from scratch. We human beings are creative. We do forge and change relations. But there is a kind of array of relations available. We call those social structures. Social structure is nothing other than a set of social relations into which people enter in their lives. So we engage in all kinds of social relations. Now, some of these relations are characterized by deep reciprocities. Friendships are an example of that. The well-being of one person in a friendship does not depend upon the ill fare of the other. Rather, if you're really in a close friendship, your well-being depends upon their well-being. Certainly in the most intimate of friendships, families, and let's take parents and children rather than spouses. Spouses can be more complicated sometimes, but certainly with most parents, with respect to their children, the parent suffers when the child suffers. The parent's well-being depends upon the flourishing of the child. There's nothing that causes more anguish for parents than worry that their child is not doing well. Right? So that's a very different kind of social relationship than exists in many other contexts. But it's an available one. That's one of the kinds of relations which you can forge in the society in which we live. And to some extent, that's an achievement, because it's not the case that all parent-child, in all societies, the parent-child relationship has quite such deep interconnections of that form. It's pretty universal, but not universal. I was just reading a paper about the Ottoman Empire in which, because of the rules of inheritance, at the very most elite levels, when the eldest son inherited a position, it was legal for that new head of the household to murder all of his brothers. That is, eliminating brothers was a legitimate way of securing your inheritance. Well, I mean, that's a pretty different kind of world. This was a paper about primogeniture. That is, rules in which only the eldest son can inherit versus rules of partible inheritance, where you divide the inheritance, versus systems that are open, that don't have either of those specific mandated procedures. Anyway, for whatever it's worth, we have many kinds of relations. One kind of relation that's available, and which actually becomes a foundational kind of relation in the sort of world we live in, are relations of exploitation. It's a particular way that human beings enter into interactions with each other. Stable, reproducible, socially sanctioned, normatively regulated, all the stuff that sociologists talk about. One type of relation is one which we would diagnose as exploitative. Then the question is, what are the criteria, what are the specific properties of relations that are distinctive to an exploitation relation? And in that in clarifying that, I moved from an original formulation, which was sort of a straightforward application of the labor theory of value way of thinking about it, to an alternative way of thinking about it that revolves around this distinction between non-exploitative oppression and exploitative oppression, so, which I shortened to oppression versus exploitation. But the way to think about it is both relations are forms of oppression, but only one adds to, or in addition to being oppressive, is also exploitative. Exploitation is a subtype within the big family of oppressive relations. The first two criteria that I enumerate in that triplet of criteria, the first two define oppression, and the third specifies the form of oppression as exploitative. So the general notion of oppression, the anchoring idea, is really the first criteria. But it turns out that the first criteria isn't quite enough to give you oppression, because the first criteria is this inverse interdependent welfare principle. My well-being depends upon your deprivations. Well, that's not quite enough to give you oppression, because we can think of situations where that condition is met, but it seems perfectly fine. There doesn't seem to be anything wrong with it. You know, the example of fair competition in a game where everybody voluntarily agrees to the rules. It is true that there's a causal interdependence between the well-being of the winners and the unhappiness of the losers. That's tough. That's the way it is. It seems a little bit of an abuse of the term oppression to say that's oppressive. If they were cheating, that's another matter. But, you know. So that's why this second principle gets put in, that the explanation for the first interdependence, it's a diagnosis of where that negative interdependence comes from. It comes from the exclusion of one group from access to resources of some sort, so this exclusionary principle. Now, to really nail down that idea of exclusion, I think you also ultimately do have, and to justify calling it oppression, rather than just exclusionary disadvantage, that's a kind of more neutral term, to add the loaded term, oppression. Oppression is a normatively loaded term. I think ultimately you do have to say something about the injustice of the exclusion. If the exclusion is fully justified, then even though there is an exclusion operating, probably you would be hesitant to say the resulting relation is one of oppression, if the exclusion is fully justified. And so there is an indictment of the process of exclusion. Now, in the big cases that one invokes, that's pretty clear. The enclosure movement in early modern Europe, where peasants were kicked off of the commons, which they had used for time immemorial and which was necessary for their subsistence, or European colonial settlers who come to lands that are occupied by people with living well-regulated traditional ways of life, and they're pushed off of the land for the benefit of the colonizers. Doesn't take a very fancy theory of justice in either of those cases to say, yes, there's an injustice here. The exclusion is not legitimate, and therefore the resulting negative interdependence of welfare is oppressive. If the exclusion had no consequences for the well-being, it would be a strange situation. You know, typically exclusions do have consequences. But if you had some special circumstance in which you establish an exclusionary process, it wasn't justified, but it had no consequences for the welfare of anybody. You know, you'd say, well, why do they do it? What's the point? But still. Probably you wouldn't, you might still say there was something wrong with it, but it wouldn't warrant this morally laden term, oppression. Oppression is a statement, I think, about this causal interdependence of the well-beings of people, of their conditions of flourishing, and then with a diagnosis of an illegitimate form of exclusion. So the Marxian version of this says property rights in the means of production are an illegitimate exclusion. The people who use the means of production should not be excluded from owning them. Property rights exclude workers from owning the means of production. Capitalists monopolize the means of production. It's not that no worker could ever become a capitalist, but once they're a capitalist, they have the power, enforced by the state, to exclude other people from using their means of production without their permission. And that underwrites the interdependence of welfare. That's the first two criteria. Then the third criteria adds this extra twist to it. The third criterion is that by virtue of that exclusionary mechanism, you are able to not only prevent other people from using these resources, but you're also able to appropriate the fruits of their labor. As you can appropriate their living, laboring activity. Yeah?
So when we're talking about welfare, we're not only referring to material well-being, right? Like, it's also like psychological well-being. Like, for example, like the racial hierarchy where like someone is deemed inferior, but what if, you know, they have equal material access to things? But it's still oppressive if that person...
Right, so yeah, when I'm talking about class oppression and class exploitation, I am referring to the material conditions of well-being. Remember, in my egalitarian moral principle, it's all people should have equal access to the material and social means necessary to live a flourishing life. So here, I'm just talking about the material means. The issue of social recognition is also relevant, and when I extend this notion to cultural exploitation and sexual exploitation and oppression, you'll see that we can extend this outside of the material range. But in the class analysis, labor exploitation is material exploitation. It's appropriating the fruits of labor, or labor effort more generally, if you want to think of it that way.
One other question.
Yeah.
So how much consensus is there on these definitions of oppression and exploitation, just in general in sociology, or is it that only Marx, in the Marxian tradition, they agree, and everybody else thinks that we shouldn't define it this way?
You know what, I just, here, I want to interrupt. I just got a message saying that my battery is low and I don't want to lose my podcast. Does anybody have a cable for a iPod-ish type thing that I can plug into? I can just plug it into any USB port. If somebody has, let's see. No, I need the, that's what I need. Okay, So that's fine. I can plug this into your USB port and plug it into here. Plug it into your USB port. And I'll plug it.
Power away.
And now we have saved the day. Okay. Great. This will, thanks. Okay. So repeat the question. It kind of got lost in my anxiety over my... Oh, no. No. This is, I elaborated this particular alternative way in the course of a dialogue with John Romer's work. So the sequence is historically, just so you get the picture here. John Romer wrote some very important, pretty difficult work on the concept of exploitation in the 1980s, which made a kind of splash in a fairly restricted circle of high-flying Marxist political economists. Romer did it in a particular way because of his way of thinking and writing, you know, very mathematical, very much oriented towards creating alternative formal models of these things. I was engaged in lots of debates with Romer. His work had a pretty big impact in kind of disturbing the way I had previously thought of things. I initially appropriated a fair amount of Romer's apparatus into my way of thinking, and then felt that there were some limits, some weaknesses in it, some gaps in it. Basically, Romer's approach only identifies those first two mechanisms, doesn't have the third criterion. And by only having the first two, it became clear that one of the key aspects of exploitation, which is the power of the exploited, got lost in Romer's way of formulating it. So I wrote some papers about that, and you know, there's some friendly debates that were launched. And then I consolidated my approach to this in the mid-90s when I published Class Counts. Now that book arrived at a time when all of the energy that had been going into Marxist class analysis had pretty much waned. You know, this was sort of after the crest of that kind of thinking. And it's in the end, the Class Counts book, I think, has had pretty limited impact on the kind of broader way that Marxists approach these things. Because it's a less active period of people really trying to integrate new ideas and create a new equilibrium consensus. It's not that I think it's had no impact, but I haven't seen people writing about exploitation in which they say, yes, weighing all these alternatives, this is the way to go. So there isn't really a consensus as far as I know. Okay. So the key punchline of the third condition is not that exploitation is even worse than oppression, than non-exploitative oppression. It's not that the thing that's most fundamentally wrong about capitalism is that labor is extracted from workers, although that's part of the critique of capitalism. It's rather that the extraction of actual labor effort forces interdependency between exploiter and exploited in a way that mere oppression doesn't. And there's some simple slogans that kind of capture this. Exploiters need the exploited. They depend upon them. And they depend upon them in one really crucial way. Some degree of voluntary expenditure of effort is required in order for the exploiter's well-being to be secure. And they have to figure out how to get that. How do you get people to cooperate when they are being exploited? Because it just turns out, in most situations, it's just too easy for people to restrict their effort. You know, even under really brutal conditions, it's easy for people to operate in less than maximum efficiency, to sabotage production, to shirk, to do all sorts of things which are suboptimal from the point of view of the exploiter. Exploitation requires cooperation. And in some, even a very thin way, it requires the consent of the exploited. Now, I don't mean consent in the wholehearted, you know, oh, this is great, but just a willingness to go along with it day after day rather than to continually subvert it. Now, one solution is what would be called a despotic form of exploitation, where the exploiter hires a lot of foremen and a lot of supervisors, and they monitor every movement by the exploited, and they are constantly with the whip, et cetera, making it extremely oppressive at the point of exploitation. But that turns out to be a pretty expensive way of exploiting people. And if you have anything but the simplest and most transparent of labor processes, it actually turns out to be pretty ineffective. It's just not a good way to get engineers and machinists and skilled workers in all sorts of work settings to use the means of production in a way that doesn't damage the means of production and which produces the kind of effort that employers want. So what exploit, and that's because the exploited have power. I mean, that's the thing to remember. The reason why you have to hire foremen and you have to have clocks to clock in and you have to have sanctions for misbehavior, the reason that you have to have all that is because the exploited have power. And that's different from the issue of from simple oppression. The main power that oppressed but not exploited people have is mayhem. That is, they can resist, but the resistance of the non-exploited oppressed quickly escalates into murderous violence. And that's reflected, as I said, in this horrible aphorism of slogan of 19th century American culture, the only good Indian is a dead Indian. Well, the only recourse to the oppressive relations the Native Americans had was physical resistance to expropriation. And that was met with force. So violence becomes the kind of ruling regime of resistance for the non-exploited oppressed, whereas a much bigger repertoire of resistance, which then requires a different repertoire of response, occurs within systems of exploitation. In most situations, you know, that again, this is a simplification, but I think it captures the essential problem. And that's what makes exploitation an important concept, because it enables us to understand the character of capacities for resistance, and therefore the counter moves that are necessary, both at the level of ideology, how do you evoke the consent of the exploited? Well, there's various ideological resources. Politically, what kind of state do you need that will invoke this and protect this kind of interdependent but conflictual relationship? And all sorts of other issues, which we'll be discussing as we go. Now extending it, the notion of this contrast between oppression and exploitation, and again, remember, when I say exploitation, I mean exploitative oppression. I don't mean that exploitation doesn't also include oppression. You can think of this also with respect to other domains of life. So I haven't thought deeply about this and really worked it out, but one can think about the distinction between cultural oppression and cultural exploitation this way. With respect to Native Americans, forms of cultural exploitation occur when all sorts of cultural products and cultural effort by Native Americans are appropriated by the dominant culture as in a way that enriches the dominant culture. So, for example, one interpretation of certain strands of New Age spirituality, which appropriate Native American motifs and Native American religious practices, can be thought of as cultural exploitation. It's appropriating the products of Native Americans. In contrast to pure cultural oppression, in which the cultural practices are to marginalize, exclude, and repress. So in the 19th century and early, actually into the first decades of the 20th century, Native American kids were taken away from their families and put in boarding schools and prohibited from speaking their language in an effort to eradicate those cultural practices rather than to appropriate them. Well, again, one can say that, well, that's not culturally exploitative. It's culturally oppressive. It's an attempt to eliminate and exclude those cultural practices entirely. Cultural exploitation has a certain commercial and abusive character to it, but it also acts as a buffer that enables the cultural practices to be preserved. So cultural exploitation, in some ways, is empowering. It gives voice, it gives a space for a cultural affirmation that pure cultural oppression without that exploitation doesn't have. And let me just give the example with sexuality, which then, you know, and then if there's some questions, we can go on with it. On the sexuality issue, it's one way of thinking about the contrast between the way in which, in a kind of traditional heterosexist, patriarchal, male-dominant world, the difference between the sexual exploitation of women and the sexual oppression of homosexuals. So sexual exploitation of women involves men appropriating the sexual effort, if you will, of women under conditions of unequal power, in which men are dependent upon that sexual effort. And it's exploitative, but it is also a source of power. And the classic, you know, images in novels and literature and cultural stories about women using their sexuality as a lever under conditions of their subordination, as a lever to create space, to create possibility for their own ability to have their needs met, using their sexuality that way, that's made possible by virtue of the fact that they're being exploited. That is, and I'm contrasting sexual exploitation from sexual reciprocity, where there's, you know, full mutual concern in a reciprocal way in a sexual relationship. Well, sexual exploitation empowers the exploited in that way. Not as much, of course, as sexual reciprocity would. So this isn't saying, just as the saying in with respect to class is, the one thing worse than being exploited in capitalism is not being exploited, meaning it's worse to be unemployed than to be employed. But that doesn't mean it's better to be exploited in capitalism than to work in a worker co-op or to be in a cooperative socialist economy. It's just that in capitalism, it's better to be exploited than not exploited. In a male-dominant sexual order, heterosexist order, it's better to be exploited than to be oppressed, to be non-exploitatively oppressed. With respect to homosexuality, on the other hand, a heterosexist oppressor is one that wants to prohibit that sexual expression altogether, criminalize it, make it illegal, and repress it. In the case of the heterosexist oppression of homosexuality, it satisfies the snap your fingers test. So the snap your fingers test is, if the oppressing group could snap their fingers and have the oppressed group just disappear, or in this case have their sexual orientation disappear, it's not necessarily that the people disappear, that's a separate matter, but their sexual orientation disappear, they would snap their fingers without hesitation. You know, Christian fundamentalists would snap their fingers. If they could snap their fingers and have homosexuality disappear from the earth, they would do so. I mean, some would hesitate for various other reasons. But they certainly, a heterosexist man wouldn't snap their fingers and have female sexuality disappear. So it's the same contrast with the only good Indian is a dead Indian. White settlers coming to North America, if they could have snapped their fingers, at least after the first couple of winters. You know, there's little historical details which don't correspond exactly to this story, but if they could have snapped their fingers and have if the continent had been unpopulated by people, it would have made the settlement of North America simpler. But they would not have snapped, you know, slave owners would not have snapped their fingers and had all Africans disappear. That would have made southern plantation agriculture much more difficult. So I think that this contrast between oppression and exploitation can be carried over into other areas. And it then raises it helps to explain different long-term institutional structures that get set up, and the kind of practices and resistance practices that emerge in different contexts around these practices. Okay, well, that was meant to be a short little add-on to the previous class. Are there thoughts and questions? Yeah, Dimitri.
Yeah, I wonder what were the specific combination of circumstances that led to oppression of Native Americans and at the same time of exploitation of Native African people. So I see such points. You said that kind of European colonists kind of benefited from exploiting African natives, right? And at the same time not benefited to the same extent from exploiting of Native Americans. I can see this difference kind of soils that Native Americans can't kind of cultivate the soil in an agrarian way that European settlers did. So.
No, that's not the historic.
Okay. Yeah. I'll give several points to this. And for instance, Native Africans have this specific kind of tropical forests which they can. Okay. Then, but at the same time, as a local museum, there was kind of extensive fur trade with Native Americans. So Europeans actually need their labor and specific skills, so they can use them in the same way. So if it's not for the soils, maybe it's kind of the culture and structure of the natives. So maybe Africans had slavery already when Europeans came.
And so the actual historical story about this is, of course, European traders did trade with in the fur industry, and that trade wasn't particularly exploitative. You know, it was trade between people who had different commodities, and they exchanged them. It wasn't theft; it was trade. The problem with there were attempts to enslave Native Americans, and it was just too easy for them to escape. That is, they had an exit option because the surrounding frontier and the areas outside of the immediate circumstance just made it too much trouble. It was ineffective bondage because of their capacity to escape into the hinterland. There were Native American tribes in the South that opted for settled agriculture, that adopted European dress, and had property rights in their land and owned slaves. The Cherokee tribes in Georgia were slave owners. So there were Native American slave owners of black slaves. In the late 20s and 30s, Andrew Jackson succumbed to pressures from white settlers, the white population in the South, to remove all Cherokees from the region. This is one of the most kind of dreadful episodes, filled with deep contradictions of the American history of the struggles against the indigenous population. So there were all these Christianized Cherokees who dressed like Europeans, they lived in log cabins, they adopted European ways of life, they had slaves, and they were all displaced to Oklahoma. That's why currently the Cherokee Nation is in Oklahoma, not in Georgia. Huge mortality rate in that displacement. It's one of the great tragic moments. And they took their slaves with them. Now, there are presently in Oklahoma black Cherokees and oil. So the Cherokee Nation is actually really rich now because they happen to be displaced into a region that had, unbeknownst to anybody at the time, is filled with oil. So they're very wealthy Cherokee tribes. The Cherokee tribe gets to distribute the royalties from the oil to its members. So it has a kind of socialist distribution system of its revenues. They've excluded the black Cherokees. You know, so because they're black, they're not. Now, of course, just like slaves everywhere, they have a lot of intermixed Cherokee ancestry. Cherokees, no less than their white slave owner, were unwilling to have sex with their slaves. So there's plenty, it's probably all, I don't know for sure, but certainly a large number of black Cherokees who have some Cherokee blood, as it's called. And it's been in the courts for years fighting over the exclusion of African-descended Cherokee slaves from these oil revenues. Yeah, so it's one of these really kind of sleazy ramifications of systems of exploitation. It's important. I mean, it's an important kind of romanticizing aspect to really bring home the fact that it's the relations that do the work, not the nobility and the culture. You know, so it's easy to romanticize victims and to therefore assume that if you've been the victim of deep and pervasive oppression, that somehow you have a deeper moral conscience than if you hadn't been. If as a result of the oppression, you happen to, for historically contingent reasons, to end up in a position where you are in relations of objective oppression and exploitation, whatever deeper cultural resonances of moral conscience that came out of that past experience are pretty quickly eroded by the present pressures of the new cultural, political, economic, structural environment.
There's still one more puzzle. I mean, in the kind of spirit of Margaret Harris, the cultural puzzle. Why some Native American tribes resisted so harshly and the others not? I mean, what was so special in their structure?
Well, mostly the argument there is, in the historical literature, is that the Plains Indians that had horses and had capacities for struggle, so that there's a... Europeans tended to think of American Indians as one category. Well, it was not. It was hundreds of different categories with very different ways of life. And just as in any other place, those who engaged in settled agriculture were less built, were less embedded in a warrior culture than those that were nomadic. And nomads from Genghis Khan to the Plains Indians were capable of resistance and armed fights in a way that settled peasants are not. I think that's the big, that you could call that cultural, but it's really more the socioeconomic structures of those communities. Yeah.
I'm trying to grapple with the differences between oppression and exploitation, and I keep thinking about the civil rights movement, and particularly when I think about the March on Washington as being the march for jobs and freedom,
right.
I think about jobs as sort of the exploitative nature of civil rights, and then freedom as being more of the oppressive. And to what extent does that make sense? And then also, when it comes to resistance of oppression, you mentioned that like physical resistance and violence is like basically the only way that you can like overcome oppression. But when I look at the civil rights movement, I see things like sit-ins and there was physical like violence and things like that, but at the same time there were things.
Yeah,
like,
right. So that's a complicated set of questions, because the issue in the civil rights movement was specifically around a particular form of exclusion based on race, and not exclusion based on property rights. The analogy to the Native Americans being excluded from the land is the marginalized population in urban ghettos being excluded from labor markets, which creates forms of conflict that have a much more directly repressive and coercive character than forms of conflict that occur within labor markets. Now, the jobs and freedom, the freedom argument was against discrimination, and the jobs argument was for inclusion, into the mainstream. You can think of the jobs as a demand to be exploited. But the freedom thing was not... The racially discriminated population was already exploited. It's just that they were exploited under more disadvantaged conditions because of racism excluding them from various kinds of opportunities. So I don't think the freedom versus jobs breaks down into exactly oppression versus exploitation, because they're operating on different dimensions of this whole kind of space.
And then the second part about the violence.
So violence, I mean, of course, it's a little... I was making a kind of general point that has its historical relevance specifically with respect to the question of the exclusion of people from land in a world where land is the pivotal resource to survive. And the resistance to that exclusion from land was to forcibly try to avoid being excluded. In the world today, this is now 150 years later, the civil rights movement was 100 years after that, there were all sorts of other legal remedies to efforts and other forms of resistance possible. to deal with would-be exclusion. So, you know, now you go to court. If some landlord wanted to take over your land, you wouldn't necessarily create a vigilante group on your border. You would sue them in court and have the police come in to prevent your being displaced from the land. You know, so recourse to the courts, of course, is still recourse to violence. I mean, what are you trying to do? You're trying to get the police on your side. You know, you're trying to enforce an exclusion or prevent an exclusion. That's what you're doing when you're going to the court. It's just that you're using the state's control over violence as your vehicle rather than private violence. In the 19th century, with the exclusion of Native Americans, the white settlers used the state's use of force. They had the military backing their move west. Native Americans did try courts. You know, there are lots of treaties that were signed, and then efforts to get those treaties enforced. When you know, there's a plaque up by the Social Science Building about the Black Hawk War. Chief Black Hawk went right by the Social Science Building. Little did he know. And treaties were signed and then ignored. If all the treaties that had been signed by Native Americans had been enforced, then of course it would still have been the case that it would have been massive exclusion, because they were treaties that ratified a particular moment of that exclusionary process, but it would have secured huge property rights for the Native Americans. And it's just that those were ignored. Okay, well, I think what we should do is take our break because it's 11. And we'll come back at 10 after. And then I think we'll do the complexity and the problems of actually thinking about class structures. We'll do it in the same kind of mode. And then hopefully in the next lecture get back on track on the lecturing for 45 minutes or so and then having a good hour of discussion. Okay, so let's take our break.
Can I actually try to?